Hey there. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting without a license at 101.1 FM and available online at freakradio.org. My name's Alexis. I'm here with Maya Ramnath.
Hello.
And this is the February 16th episode of the Feminist Radio Collective happening. I'm going to play you, a little intro. You can see what you think. This is what we've been doing. And, oh no, I don't have it. Never mind. What we have in store for you today is an interview with Maureen Trimble, who's been just back from the World Social Forum, and she's going to talk to us about that happening and other things.
Yeah, she's going to talk to us a little bit about the World Social Forum in general, but in particular about a kind of a companion mobilization called the Feminist Dialogue, which is a part of that.
So she'll be in at about 10:30 today. And then we've also got a bit of a kind of slightly less newsy show than sometimes you get in this slot. We're going to be doing some stuff in recognition of African American History Month and thinking about some of the important African American women that don't necessarily get heard very much. Some who do. So we're going to have some readings from Audre Lorde, June Jordan, and also Angela Davis's great sort of rundown on important African-American women in history who don't get thought of or recognized very much. So all of that in store. Also a report back on the current abstinence-only sex ed that's sweeping the nation and why that might be considered a feminist issue, and a few other things. You're also welcome to call in with info, questions, things you want us to announce, anything like that. We're happy to do so. The number here at the station is 427-3772, and we're available to take your calls. You can also email us at feministmenace@graffiti.net if you are inclined towards email. So we're going to start things off with just a little song. This is Kinney Star.
Girls wear their hair up off their lovely faces, and some gaze straight ahead because they are trying to go places. Sometimes we go together and other times apart, but I'd like to think we hold our fists up, trying to make a new start. But here is a story about walking the other day, and every day's special, but some things just never change. See, he looks at she looks away, okay, hips sway, why is every day a boy day? He looks at she looks away, okay, hips sway, I guess it's another boy day. And we could call it out when it doesn't suit us both, 'cause there's a magnitude of choices and a really big boat, and that big boat floats on a restless ocean, singing about the chances of protective devotion for the girlfriend who stands on the street waiting on a trick, and some man demands that she lift her skirt quick. She's got a mother, a daughter, and a lover. You tell me why she shouldn't have safe cover. She's got a mother, a daughter, and a lover. You tell me why she shouldn't have safe cover. 'Cause if the laws made sense, she would have a legal fence to keep her clientele clean, and she could still pay the rent. She's got a mother, a daughter, and a lover. You tell me why she shouldn't have safe cover. She's got a mother, a daughter, and a lover. You tell me why she shouldn't have safe cover. Now, my skin is green. Some think it's Italian that gives me that sheen. And I have to thank my father for the proud red blood that makes me mean. But see, boy on the street's got his eyes pinned onto me. Buttons unbuttoned in his head, he wants to see the shades and the sizes, the handprints, shoe fits. Shades, sizes, handprints, shoe fits. The shades, the sizes, the handprints, the shoe fits. And off with the underwear, my dreamy smell lies there, but this is not fair, 'cause he penetrates me with his stare. This is not fair, 'cause he penetrates me with his stare. 'Cause I wanna walk down the long paths of flowers. I wanna sing songs that mesmerize for hours. I wanna feel the freedom to be sexy without his eyes sliding all up and under me. I wanna feel that freedom to be sexy without his eyes sliding all up under into me. Buttons unbuttoned in his head, what does he see?
And that is Kinney Starr with a song off of her Tidy album. I'm going to start things off with some reading from Angela Davis's book, Women, Race, and Class. And the reason we're doing this is that we think it's important to have a sense of what's happening in the present, obviously, and we're going to have some things from the present, but also that there's a quality of not necessarily knowing all the things that happened in the past. And one of the ways that I think this gets shown is, I was reading an essay in June Jordan's On Call political essays book, and thinking about sort of having a sense of our history and where we're coming from. And June Jordan's talking about being at a gathering where people, and this is, you know, not an uncommon story, where people are asked to name more than one African-American woman, and, you know, they can name two, and, you know, important African-American women in history. And someone in the room says, well, if my life depended on it, I could name more than two. And June Jordan says it, but there is a sense in which your life depends on it. You know, it's a question of what kinds of lives we can lead. So I've always appreciated Angela Davis's book, Women, Race, and Class, in part because of the kinds of histories that it does. And I think that that's one of the things that is significant about her. So I'm just going to read some sections from this chapter of the book called Communist Women, in which she talks about some of these lost histories. So she begins this essay. She says, in 1848, the year Karl Marx and Frederick Engels published their Communist Manifesto, Europe was the scene of countless revolutionary uprisings. One of the participants in the Revolution of 1848, an artillery officer and close co-worker of Marx and Engels, named Joseph Weidemeyer, immigrated to the United States and founded the first Marxist organization in the country's history. When Weidemeyer established the Proletarian League in 1852, no women appear to have been associated with the group. If indeed there were any women involved, they have long since faded into historical anonymity. Over the next few decades, women continued to be active in their own labor associations, in the anti-slavery movement, and in the developing campaign for their own rights. But to all intents and purposes, they appear to have been absent from the ranks of the Marxist socialist movement. Like the Proletarian League, the Working Men's National Association, and the Communist Club are utterly dominated by men. Even the Socialist Labor Party was also predominantly male. By the time the Socialist Party was founded in 1900, the composition of the socialist movement had begun to change. As the general demand for women's equality grew stronger, women were increasingly attracted to the struggle for social change. They began to assert their right to participate in this new challenge to the oppressive structures of their society. From 1900 on, to a greater or lesser extent, the Marxist left would feel the influence of its female adherents. As the main champion of Marxism for almost two decades, the Socialist Party supported the battle for women's equality. For many years, in fact, it was the only political party to advocate women's suffrage. Thanks to such socialist women as Pauline Newman and Rose Schneiderman, a working-class suffrage movement was forged, breaking the decade-long stronghold of middle-class women on the mass campaign to vote. By 1908, the Socialist Party had created a National Women's Commission. On March 8 of that year, women socialists active on New York's Lower East Side organized a mass demonstration in support of equal suffrage, whose anniversary continues to be observed all over the world as International Women's Day. When the Communist Party was founded in 1919, actually, two communist parties, which later united, were established. Former Socialist Party women were among its earliest leaders and activists. Mother, Ella Reeve Bloor, Anita Whitney, Margaret Prevey, Kate Sadler, Greenhall, Rose Pastor Stokes, and Jeanette Pearl were all communists who had been associated with the left wing of the Socialist Party. Although the International Workers of the World was not a political party, and in fact opposed the organization of political parties, it was the second major influence in the formation of the Communist Party. The IWW, popularly known as the Wobblies, was founded in June of 1905. Defining itself as an industrial union, the IWW proclaimed that there could never be a harmonious relationship between the capitalist class and the workers it employed. The Wobblies' ultimate goal was socialism, and their strategy was unrelenting class struggle. I just have a lot of fondness for the Wobblies.
I love the Wobblies, and it's actually relevant to, well, it's not quite relevant. It's indirectly relevant to something I want to talk about in a little bit that's happening now on campus, but I'll get to that a little later.
Okay, so back at that in your minds. When Big Bill Haywood convened that first meeting, two of the leading labor organizers who sat on the platform were women, Mother Mary Jones and Lucy Parsons. While both the Socialist Party and the IWW admitted women to their ranks and encouraged them to become leaders and agitators, only the IWW embraced a complementary policy of forthright struggle against racism. Under the leadership of Daniel de Leon, the Socialist Party did not acknowledge the unique oppression of black people. Although the majority of black people were agricultural workers, sharecroppers, tenant farmers, and farm laborers, the Socialists argued that only the proletarians were relevant to their movement. Even the outstanding leader, Eugene Debs, argued that black people required no overall defense of their rights to be equal and free as a group. Since the Socialists' overriding concern was the struggle between capital and labor, so Debs maintained, quote, we have nothing special to offer the Negro, end quote. As for the International Workers of the World, their main goal was to organize the wage-earning class and to develop revolutionary socialist class consciousness. Unlike the Socialist Party, however, the IWW focused explicit attention on the special problems of black people. According to Mary White Ovington, quote, there are two organizations in this country that have shown they do care about full rights for the Negro. The first is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The second organization that attacks Negro segregation is the Industrial Workers of the World. The IWW has stood with the Negro. And I believe that quote is from like 1910 or something. Helen Holman was a black socialist, a leading spokesman in the campaign to defend her imprisoned party leader, Kate Richards O'Hare. As a black woman, however, Helen Holman was a rarity within the ranks of the Socialist Party. Prior to World War II, the numbers of black women working in industry were negligible. As a consequence, they were all but ignored by Socialist Party recruiters. The socialist posture of negligence vis-a-vis black women was one of the unfortunate legacies the Communist Party would have to overcome. According to the communist leader and historian William Z. Foster, during the early 1920s, the party was neglectful of the particular demands of Negro women in industry. Over the next decade, however, communists came to develop the centrality of racism in U.S. society. They developed a serious theory of black liberation and forged a consistent activist record in the overall struggle against racism. So we could break now for a song.
Yeah, okay. Those were the words of Angela Davis, Women, Race, and Class. And now I think, how about some Sweet Honey in the Rock on Fannie Lou Hamer?
Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer. Now a few more black people stand there. Fannie Lou Hamer. On her life was fired from her job, scorned and kicked off the farm. Fannie Lou. That's what the lady would yell. Her body was beaten
And she walked crippled, trying to vote. She was thrown in jail. They marched, took their lives in their hands. Fannie Lou.
Sweet Honey in the Rock on Fannie Lou Hamer, famous as the lady who was sick and tired of being sick and tired, SNCC field secretary and co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in 1964, who faced jail, beatings, and death threats in her tireless work for civil rights and voting rights for African Americans. So now I want to segue into something that's pretty relevant to the issue of women, race, and class, and it's also relevant to current labor struggles at the UCSC campus. So on Monday of this week, several hundred UCSC students and employees celebrated Valentine's Day by holding a lively demonstration at the library and budget offices to demand answers on where the UC's money is going. For example, why student fees are slated for a 10% increase in the next few years, and why 80% of UC employees, including clerical and service workers, now in contract negotiations, do not receive a living wage and have not gotten a cost of living adjustment raise in years. Meanwhile, the new incoming chancellor has been offered an annual salary of $275,000 plus $68,000 relocation fee. In addition, a new management post has been created for her domestic partner, attached to a $192,000 salary and additional $50,000 relocation fee. So why am I talking about this on feminist radio? Well, because the chancellor has in effect been made a scapegoat and whipping girl in all of this. But given the current factors in women's and queer rights, it's not that simple. So I would like to read this letter written by queer members of Grad Student Solidarity Network, who were part of the coalition along with the Student Worker Coalition, Q and AFSCME, who organized this demonstration. And then maybe that will illuminate some of these issues and why we need to keep thinking about them and not just vilify people. Dear friends and colleagues, we are writing as queer-identifying members of the Graduate Student Solidarity Network, which has formed as a grassroots voice for grad students concerned about labor issues on this campus. This Monday, February 14th at noon, the Student Worker Coalition for Justice will be holding, or actually held, a welcome rally for the new chancellor on her first day of work, in an effort to share our vision of what labor practice on this campus should be like in the midst of the UC budget crisis, redistribution crisis. Thus, our primary concern in writing this letter is support for Q and AFSCME's struggle for labor rights. It is not the appointment of the new chancellor. However, it is impossible to ignore Chancellor Denton's appointment. and the appointment of her partner and the cost of both. Many of us wish heartily that the Chancellor's personal life had never been brought into this. But the fact is, whether we like it or not, it's already been done. Chancellor Denton and her domestic partner, Dr. Kalonji, have been placed in the spotlight at the heart of the turmoil. It's a complex, nuanced issue, but for this reason we think it's important to address. First, as we are all aware, the civil rights of queer people and legal recognition of non-heterosexual partnerships are under attack at the constitutional level. Therefore, it's of tremendous positive significance that not only has an openly queer woman been hired for a top-level administrative post at a major university, but that in addition, her partner has been substantively recognized as such. Second, equal opportunity for women in academia is precarious. Harvard President Larry Summers' recent remarks on the alleged biological inferiority of women in the sciences caused a national furor, and rightly so. In this context, UCSC's prominent hire of two top-tier female scientists is an important refutation of this kind of entrenched institutional sexism. For both of these aspects, the UC should be commended. However, none of it justifies or ameliorates the serious, systemic inequalities which we cannot afford to ignore. The price of the Chancellor's appointment is the hardship of the workers, both queer and straight, who are at the foundation of the university structure. Therefore, we would like to ask you, as queer members of this community and their supporters, to come to this event. Okay, sorry, this part's over. This part's a little out of date. But as conscientious queers, our voices matter in this. Let these voices be consistent in calling for social justice and economic equity. We cannot buy status and assimilation at the expense of others. This is why we're asking you to join us in calling the university out on its wealth distribution problem. Economic justice and civil rights are not mutually exclusive. We cannot let exploitation stand behind a shield of political correctness. And I want to add a little postscript. There was a quote in the San Jose Mercury News the other day saying the chancellor's job is, part of her job is to bridge the old UCSC of feminist studies and social justice and the new UCSC of astrophysics, molecular biology, and nanotechnology. And it blows my mind that we should be asked to choose between these things. So my final postscript, I just want to add a quote from Lucy Parsons now to tie all this together. So if Lucy were here, the great Lucy Parsons, by the way, daughter of slaves, anarcho-syndicalist, Haymarket widow, labor rights militant, defender of free speech who spoke out powerfully against race and gender oppression until her death in 1942, since the 1870s, if she were here, her message to Q and AFSCME might be, quote, "The manifestations of discontent now looming upon every side show that society is conducted on wrong principles and that something has got to be done soon, or the waged class will sink into a slavery worse than that of the feudal serf. I say to the wage class, think clearly and act quickly, or you are lost. Strike not for a few cents more an hour, because the price of living will be raised faster still, but strike for all you earn. Be content with nothing less." Yay, Lucy.
So we're going to play another Sweet Honey in the Rock song. This is maybe a little bit ironic or snippy or something, but it's the song Comin' to Me. And in its traditional formation, this is basically a song about giving yourself over to the Lord. But you can read it as being about those who labor, being able to trust themselves to those who don't labor. And I'm meaning this song right now as a call for high-paid execs who are taking big bonuses to give some back to the folks that labor.
That I live in, and I will.
We're now going to go into a interview conversation with Maureen, who just walked in here glowing. And so I'm going to turn the mic over to Maya Ramnath. Welcome, Maureen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is Maureen Turnbull, who recently returned from the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil.